Hello, you're listening to The Northern Agenda, the podcast that steps outside the Westminster bubble to bring you politics news for the North and crucially from the North. I'm Rob Parsons, a journalist who keeps an eye on the ups and downs of politics across Northern England so you don't have to, and condense it all into a daily email newsletter and weekly podcast. This week, we'll be hearing about the shocking report into the North-South divide impacting our most vulnerable young people, with one in every 52 children in Blackpool in care compared to just one in every 278 in affluent areas of the southeast. How did this happen? I'll be asking one of the academics behind the report about this, so stick around for that. First though, let's chat through some of the most interesting Northern politics stories you might have missed with friend of the podcast, the Liverpool Echo's Liam Thorpe. Liam, how are things?
Not bad, mate. I was just saying we've both recovered from our awards due hangovers and I'm fighting fit again.
Excellent. Yeah, it's almost obligatory to have too much free wine, isn't it, at the regional press awards where we were at in London's swanky West End. It was a good do.
It was. We consoled ourselves for not winning any awards with all the free champagne and wine. So, yeah, I'm back in the land of the living today.
Good stuff. Well, yeah, likewise. Well, now there's loads of local politics stories to discuss in your patch, Liam. But I thought before we get onto those, we'd just chat about the big, one of the big national stories, which is developing as we record this podcast. It's all about a man called Mark Menzies, the Conservative or ex-Conservative MP for the Lancashire coastal constituency of Fylde. He was stripped last night of the Conservative whip. And he's been reported to have used thousands of pounds given by donors to fund medical expenses and to have made a late night call to a 78-year-old aide asking for help because he had been locked up by bad people demanding money for his release. It's an extraordinary story in the Times today. Great bit of investigative journalism by Billy Kember. Mark Menzies, for his part, he disputes the allegations, but the Conservative Party is looking into the claims and taking them very seriously. And I mean, I've reported this in the newsletter today. It's interesting that three Conservative MPs in that part of Lancashire are either under investigation or have had to quit Parliament in disgrace. Scott Benton, Blackpool South, was caught promising to lobby ministers on behalf of the gambling industry. And Blackpool North and Cleverley's MP, Paul Maynard, is under investigation over claims he charged taxpayers while producing political materials. And I mean, it's been a bad week for Rishi Sunak polling-wise. The Conservatives are at their lowest ever polling score since Ipsos Mori started their regular voting survey, with just 19% of voters saying they would back them. And the scores he's getting are comparable to the polling record of John Major in the early to mid-90s before Labour's landslide win. And it kind of feels a bit to me like all the sleaze and all the stories about MPs is quite similar to that period where it's sort of all coming out of the woodwork in the weeks and months before an inevitable Conservative defeat. I mean, what did you make of this whole Mark Menzies story?
Absolutely extraordinary. It was like something out of a sort of a novel, really, or some kind of sort of racy fiction. It was very disturbing allegations, just bizarre, really. I think the wider question, once you get past the kind of the detail of, you know, the late night phone call to the 78-year-old advisor, the kind of talk of bad people and what might happen, you know, as I say, astounding details. The wider question is, why, when we know that the Conservatives have known about this since January, why has he only lost the whip now? And the only answer you can possibly give is because people have found out, because journalists have found out. So that's not party discipline, is it? If it's when you're aware of something so serious as this, you know, potentially 14 grand of campaign funds being used on medical bills, another 6.5 allegedly being used to pay off, you know, whoever these people may be. They're not good people, are they? If you're having to be paid off to be allowed out of your flat or whatever's happened there. So surely the whip should have immediately been withdrawn. Why weren't the police informed? You know, Conservatives are very happy to call the police on Angela Rayner without really explaining why or what it is that they think she's done. Whatever they do allege is far less, surely far less serious than what's gone on here. It's very much kind of an issue of party discipline. I totally agree with what you were saying there, that it feels like the kind of last days of Rome at the moment with the Conservatives, where all of this bad stuff is just coming out, you know, every week. Rishi Sunak must just dread picking up copies of the Times every morning because he doesn't know what the hell he's going to read next about one of his MPs, whether it's, you know, I saw someone tweet before saying, I was old enough to remember that, the texting scandal with William Ragg. And that was last week. it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, the scandals are coming thick and fast, aren't they?
They are. But it feels like there's very little discipline there. I don't know what the Whip's office are doing, really. Why on earth you wouldn't feel the need to withdraw the Whip at a much earlier stage to let it get to this point is very poor discipline. So it's more bad news for Rishi Sunak, as if he needed that. You're right, his polling is extraordinarily poor, and it just feels like a kind of dying dynasty at the moment that you just is just crumbling bit by bit every week. But obviously, you wouldn't get that from reading certain right-leaning newspapers who prefer to focus on a different story in the Angela Rayner stuff, which we obviously don't really know. And they haven't really, the Tories involved haven't really explained what they are accusing her of.
No. Well, I mean, we do know, because it's been reported, I think, that Greater Manchester Police is devoting at least a dozen police officers to investigating various claims that have been made about Angela Rayner and her domestic arrangements in Stockport and those of her husband, and to what extent she was liable for certain types of tax, and whether she's broken electoral law. All that is going on. I imagine it's going to rumble on for a few weeks. But there was an extraordinary appearance by James Daly, the Bury MP and Tory deputy party chairman, it was his complaint to Greater Manchester Police that prompted this whole investigation. He keeps popping up on TV shows like Sky News and being asked, what exactly is it that you're accusing Angela Rayner of? And there was another example of it yesterday on Sky News. And he refuses to say what the actual specifics of the complaint are, which I just don't understand. Like, he says, the whole thing is with Greater Manchester Police. He doesn't want to jeopardise the investigation. But surely you can say what it is you think Angela Rayner has done wrong. And when you see that, it's very hard not to be quite cynical about their motivations for pursuing this, which are obviously to drag down Angela Rayner at a sensitive political time, maybe even force her to resign if she is found to have done something wrong. I mean, the sort of comparison between the two, this story and the Mark Menzies story, is really quite stark, isn't it?
It's extremely stark. And, you know, I think Angela Rayner, you know, has wanted to keep her private life private. She's now said that if she's found to have, you know, committed a criminal offence, whatever it is that they're alleging, then she'll resign. And I think I would predict what we'll probably see is that she hasn't, and that she will then be kind of rewarded, a bit like Keir Starmer was with the beer gate in Durham. He got a polling bounce after that because he put himself out there and he'd said that. Are the Daily Mail or other newspapers calling for Mark Menzies to be investigated by the police? It seems like there is some double standards here. And for James Daly to sit there on show after show after show and refuse to say what it is that he is alleging, you know, Beth Rigby was, you know, looked as astounded as any of us on Sky and said, but you wrote a letter to them. So what did you put in that letter? And I can't understand, because it wouldn't be jeopardizing the investigation. No one's been charged. The police will do their job, whatever happened. But from a political point of view, why he cannot say, and, you know, it does he not know? Is he not sure about what he's gone to the police over? If you're confident of something to go to the police, you should be able to say what it is. And, you know, I think anyone looking over at that story, it's changed quite a few times, from whether it's to do with, you know, the tax she's paid on a house sale, whether it's to do with the electoral roll. We're not quite sure. And I don't understand why he can't say. So, yeah, I think there is some double standards going on. And it'll be interesting to see if some of those newspapers pursue Mark Menzies with the same vigour that they have done Angela Rayner. I would predict not.
I think you're right. Well, we will see how that unfolds over the next few weeks. Now let's turn to slightly more local matters, but still extremely interesting. And you, Liam, in the last few weeks, I think it's been dragging on even longer than the Angela Rayner saga, you have been trying to get Liverpool City Council to name two councillors who were summoned to court for non-payment of council tax. And that has reached a conclusion of sorts this week, hasn't it? Tell us how that sort of all unfolded.
It has, yeah. And so for a little bit of potted history on this, I used to work for a newspaper called The Bolton News many years ago. And while we were there, not myself, but a colleague did a sort of similar story on this, using freedom of information laws to find out if any elected councillors had received a court summons over the non-payment or the late payment of council tax. Now, you know, this is a public interest matter because, of course, anyone can fall into debt, anyone can get into issues, but, you know, people are their elected councillors. We pay our council tax, which funds councillors and council business. So it is a matter of public interest. Of course, it's a potential illegality if they then go on to vote on matters of the budget while they are in such arrears. But even without that, I think it is a matter of public interest. And so when I came to the Echo, I should say that the Bolton News pursued that all the way to the courts because the council had refused to name councillors involved, and they won a landmark judgment at the upper tier tribunal, which agreed that it is a matter of public interest. So when I then came to the Echo, I thought I'll do the same in Liverpool, and using that that judgment, the council agreed straight away, and we named, I think it was 8 councillors at the time who had received court summons. That was in 2017. So after 5 years later, or sorry, longer than that, 7 years later. God, that time's gone fast, hasn't it? Yeah, I thought I would do the same thing again, just to see if there's any new councillors that found themselves in that position. And they came back and said 2 had, but they wouldn't tell me who they were. I was really surprised by that, given the legal precedent that had been set down. Challenged it, as you do, as you'll know, Rob, initially through an internal review, which didn't find obviously in my favour. But the council, I think, knew they were on shaky ground at this point because they referred themselves to the information commissioner to ask for guidance, and I did the same. I escalated to the ICO, and to be honest, I was pretty confident that they would find in my favour because of that judgment, because of that ruling, and they did. And this week, they gave the council 35 days to release the identities of the two involved, and this week, those two people came forward. Now, I want to say at this point that we always knew there was a possibility that there would be some compelling explanations, because, as I say, people can find themselves in difficulty. And it is my belief that if the council in the first instance had given this information, it would have been a lot easier for everyone. But we had to pursue it because the council was refusing it. It's an issue of transparency. The longer we then pursued it, the longer they put up a fight, getting the ICO involved, it created much more of a saga, which then made it, will undoubtedly then make it harder for the two people involved. You know, those councillors have both given, I think, strong reasons for why they ended up in this situation. And I thought they spoke well about their situations. And I wanted people to be able to see that and make their own minds up. And many have sympathised. You know, no one's calling for them to resign or anything like that. But people should know and make their own call. So I think that the council itself has not done anyone a service in its denial of this. Liverpool Council has been accused of a lack of transparency on a fair few things. You'll remember my investigation into the parking tickets as well. So it's kind of wrapped up in that. It's come to a conclusion now, and I think people can move on. But it should never have had to get this far.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, you're right that Liverpool City Council have made it into a bigger story by their initial refusal to reveal the councillors' identities. And yeah, I read their explanations as to why they got into these difficulties. And yeah, I mean, they are very, without going into too much detail, like, they're really, really heartrending, and you do sympathise with them, I think, quite a lot. But I do think it is a fair point that if you put yourself into elected office,
you have to expect a higher level of scrutiny, don't you? You know, and we have had a bit of criticism of people saying, you know, did you have to pursue this? We didn't know the reasons. If the council had come forward much, much earlier and said, these are the people and you can sit down with them, it would have been a different type of story, I think, and it wouldn't have been such a kind of pursuit of these, you know, of their identities because of what the council had done. And I also think, yeah, you get a higher level of scrutiny, and particularly with council tax, because everyone pays it, and it quite literally pays for the council. So I think there is a more of a public interest there as well. We're not, you know, we know we live in a poor city. We're not going out to kind of make people's lives harder who have had difficulties, but these people are elected politicians, and they kind of have to expect that level of scrutiny, I think.
Yeah, and also the circumstances that they describe, so the mental health difficulties and such like, and the fact that those have led to not being able to pay council tax. I imagine that situation would be quite similar for lots of non-elected politicians who have got themselves into trouble with council tax or other things. So in some respects, it's sort of it's shining a light on the fact that even elected councillors can have these problems, and you know how the cost of living crisis is impacting on all of us. So I think
not to forget that you know there are very good reasons for this, and we could talk about this all day, but councillors and in every local council these days are voting to increase council tax every year. Now, as I say, there are usually good reasons for that, mainly because the rest of their funding has been cut so dramatically by the government, and they're unfairly having to rely on council tax more and more. But still, as somebody pointed out to me on Twitter, these people are likely to have voted for increases in council tax, which will obviously have made people's lives harder. So again, it just invites that extra layer of scrutiny if they have struggled to pay it themselves.
Yeah. Now, let's move on to a completely different story, also another really interesting one. Can you just explain to our listeners why Michael Heseltine, Tory grandee, former Deputy Prime Minister under Margaret Thatcher, was speaking out in the House of Lords this week about the former Mayor of Liverpool, Joe Anderson, quite a controversial figure in your part of the world?
Well, I can't explain why he did it, but I can explain what he said, because I was a little bit astounded myself when you Rob actually pointed out that you'd seen it. I'd had a whisper of this the week before. Someone had suggested to me that this might be happening, and you let me know with your studious work covering the House of Lords program that Lord Heseltine, you know, the so-called Minister for Merseyside, probably the only Tory who can kind of walk around Liverpool and have his hand shaked and be welcomed, who did, you know, so much for this city in the 80s and 90s. He, you know, many people credit Michael Heseltine with the revival of Liverpool, or certainly playing a big part in the revival of Liverpool, whether it's the Albert Docks, the Garden Festival, giving Liverpool a chance after a very difficult time of mass unemployment, civil unrest, and obviously the bitter war between the Labour-led militant council and Margaret Thatcher. It's my understanding that in later years, you know, Michael Heseltine's always returned to Liverpool. He's got great love for Liverpool. And when Joe Anderson was leader of the council and then mayor, they formed a friendship. In fact, Joe Anderson officially handed Michael Heseltine freedom of the city when he was leader of the council here. And they remained friendly. Now, obviously, Joe Anderson was then arrested in 2020 as part of a corruption investigation by Merseyside Police looking at building contracts in the city. He stepped down as mayor and he didn't obviously fight the next election. I should say at this point that he has always denied wrongdoing and he hasn't been charged. And that last point is kind of what Michael Heseltine was getting at. So that was, you know, December 2020, we're now in April 2024, and Michael Heseltine was saying in the House of Lords that he was asking the question, you know, to have someone who has lost so much in what Joe Anderson has in terms of his job and his reputation, and he simply asked, is this justice? Now, I don't know what answer he was expecting, because the minister in the Lords quite rightly said, what, I cannot comment on this because there's a live police investigation. It's still ongoing. What can I actually say? But it was interesting how Lords then sort of started popping up from across the political divide to agree with Lord Heseltine, to say that, you know, it was sort of very unfair that this has gone on for so long. I think some people would have some sympathy with that, whatever you think of a person. You know, it's, you know, 3.5 years of having a police investigation kind of hanging over your head and not knowing what it means and not being able to kind of I guess, live properly. So yeah, it was just not something I was expecting to be reporting on that day. And yeah, an interesting intervention from a Tory grandee. But it won't change anything. One interesting line that the minister did say was that the Merseyside police had told him that they are looking to conclude their investigations, as quickly as possible. And he sort of strongly hinted that that might be quite soon, because obviously that's massive ramifications for the city. There's multiple people arrested linked to the council. We're all kind of waiting to see if anyone gets charged, who might get charged, and how things will proceed. I think it was June last year that the file was officially handed over from the police to the CPS to kind of make a decision on charges. So we're waiting for that one. And from what they said in the House of Lords, they're looking to move as quickly as they can on that. But we don't know how long that means.
Yeah, well, these things do usually move very slowly, don't they? And I suspect Lord Heseltine's motivation for raising it in the Lords is so that, it brought it back onto the agenda, and people like myself and you are now talking about it. It's made a few news articles around the country, so I guess perhaps that's job done from that point of view. Let's talk about the Hillsborough disaster. So Liverpool and other places fell silent this week to mark 35 years since the Hillsborough disaster in 1989, the Britain's worst sporting disaster. And I guess whenever there's a anniversary of this type, it gives us an opportunity to look at what's changed and where we are in terms of learning the lessons of Hillsborough, and potentially even changing the legal system to make sure the things that allowed Hillsborough to happen don't happen again. And there's been a few people talking about that this week, haven't there? Where do we stand with that?
Yeah, so I you're right. Every time there is an anniversary, it's a chance to reflect, obviously, on the lives that were lost, the lives that were ruined, the families that lost their loved ones on a day that they went to a football match. That's the most important thing, to think about them, to think about everything that happened on that day and since. But it is also a chance to think about how things can change. And for so long, it was nothing had changed. And it's only through the incredible relentlessness of the families that things at least did start to change, with some political help, with some media help as well along the way. And we got to the new inquests, which correctly found that 97 people were unlawfully killed at a football match. There has, unfortunately, while there has been the truth, there has not been justice. And I spoke to David Conn this week, the Guardian journalist, who, along with my friend and colleague Dan Kay, who sadly lost his life last year, that I would say those two are up there with two of the people in the media who have done the most to try and right the wrongs of Hillsborough. And David spoke eloquently and passionately about the justice system, and that he asked, how on earth can you have it that an inquest finds that 97 people have been unlawfully killed, and yet no one person has been held to account for that? That can't be right, can it? And also, how was it the case that in the weeks after Hillsborough, there was a report by the Taylor report, which found that the police were culpable, and yet this was followed by inquests which didn't find this, which found accidental death, and then years and years, decades and decades of people being ignored when they wanted to overturn this. And it was only when, and I did a piece on this as well, it was only after certain things happened, certain political interventions after the 20th anniversary, which led to the then Labour government launching the independent panel, which then was an incredibly explosive and formidable panel that really brought everything out into the open, and that then led to the inquest and the correct verdict. So the one thing that's come out of this is the need for a change in the law, and the fact that for a long time now the families have and others have campaigned for a Hillsborough law. And it was really, really disappointing at the end of last year when the Conservative government, after 6 years of delays, finally responded to a report by Bishop Jones of Liverpool, and they then basically decided not to bring in a full Hillsborough law. Now, for your listeners who don't know, a full Hillsborough law contains a number of measures, but the most important one is called a duty of candor on public officials who are giving evidence to, you know, inquiries, public inquiries, any public officials, that they have to tell the truth. It's pretty remarkable that you think we need to have a law about this, but we know from Hillsborough that the police changed their statements. They changed statements of younger officers of what happened, and they told lies to try and smear the Liverpool fans and try and blame the Liverpool fans. So this is a, you know, Andy Burnham's obviously called for it for a long time, MPs like Ian Byrne and others. So that's the main thing, but there's also other elements to it, like a parity of funding for, you know, legal funding for, you know, ordinary people who get caught up in these disasters, because Hillsborough is one of many that we've seen in terms of, you know, whether it's Grenfell, even things like the post office, where ordinary people get caught up in this terrible situation, and it's not a level playing field. So a Hillsborough law would start to level that playing field. I think David Conn was saying there's more that needs to happen in terms of the justice system. But importantly, Keir Starmer has committed to bringing in a Hillsborough law, and said it would be. He previously said that we spoke to him in 2022, and he confirmed that he would be bringing that in. And then he said that at Labour conference, and we thought ahead of the 35th anniversary, we would get a new commitment from him. It looks like he's about to become our new prime minister, and we wanted to be absolutely certain, you know, that he will bring in a Hillsborough law. I don't think it's not going to cost much. It's probably quite an easy thing to do. And he confirmed that it would be a priority for an incoming Labour government. And I think, you know, that's something that the families can hold on to. It's a potentially positive legacy. They've been through so much hurt, so many disappointments, so many obstacles. So here there is, you know, they're not going to get justice now. They're just not going to. The legal routes have been exhausted. So here is an opportunity for a lasting legacy to try and make it so that others don't go through the same, you know, the same hell that they did in the same way. And I think that's the absolute least they deserve.
Yeah, absolutely right. Liam, we'll finish our chat with something a bit lighter. And I saw you tweeting about this just a few minutes ago when you were out in Liverpool city centre. You probably need to be, if you're out and about in Liverpool with a sandwich or a sausage roll or something like that, you probably need to keep your wits about you, don't you? What? Tell me why.
Oh, mate, we're under attack over here. So, yeah, we've been branding them XL gullies. Liverpool has massive, massive seagulls. And I've been noticing this for a while, actually, over a few years. Obviously, we're very near the coast. And they seem to be getting bigger and bigger every year. And I don't think it's just Liverpool. I've been told by it, there's plenty in other places as well. But there is a bit of a phenomenon. And I've spoken to kind of environmentalists and some other people. And there is a more serious point to this, which is that, you know, these birds, I don't blame them at all, by the way. They're essentially, they've swapped, you know, fish, sort of trying to fish in overfished waters to come inland and basically find food. And they're finding it quite easily because people are just dropping food, leaving rubbish on the floor. You know, I've done quite a bit of work on the kind of the situation with litter in Liverpool. It's really bad. But in this kind of throwaway culture where people are buying more food, takeaway, throwing bits on the floor, leaving wrappers everywhere. And the seagulls are thinking, right, well, I'm going to have a bit of that. And I think the combination of that and how much food is around means they're getting, you know, they're hench, as the kids would say. And I have seen, just the other day, actually, me and a couple of friends were walking through an area of Liverpool behind the town hall called Exchange Flags. And this poor fella comes out of a sandwich shop. He looked happy as Larry with his fresh sandwich about to tuck in. And in comes this massive seagull, takes the whole sandwich out of his hands and you know, heads off with it. He's the word crestfallen did not quite cover it. But yeah, everyone talks about it. And obviously XL gullies, there's a bit of a play on XL bullies, but it's a real thing. They're big and they're here and they're organised.
It sounds terrifying. I might have to bring a flak jacket or something next time I go to Liverpool, or at least eat my sandwiches indoors.
Yeah, bring an armoured umbrella. I think that's what you need. I watched one. We had one. This was a couple of years ago during the pandemic, and our brilliant photographer Andy Tebay caught this moment where because of the pandemic restrictions, deliveries would be often left on a front step. And this person had brought a delivery or something on the front step. And within seconds, the seagull just went in, opened it up, took the whole lot and ran off with it. And you've just got to admire scavenging like that, really. I've got nothing but respect for it.
No, well, I mean, they're just doing what they, you know, looking out for themselves, aren't they? Which I guess is what we what we all do. Liam, thank you very much. A great roundup of what's going on in Merseyside. That's Liam Thorpe from the Liverpool Echo.
Cheers.
Now, if you listen to this podcast regularly, you'll have heard about lots of different examples of the north of England being on the wrong end of stark regional inequalities. But this was a new one on me, the big differences in the numbers of vulnerable children going into care between our region and other parts of the country. A new report out this week sets out how one in every 52 children in Blackpool is in care, compared with an average of one in 140 across England, while the north accounts for just over a quarter of the child population, but more than a third of the children in care. There's obviously a human cost to this, but an economic one too. Researchers for Health Equity North say if the north of England had experienced the same rates of children entering care as the south between 2019 and 2023, it would have saved at least £25 billion. So let's find out why this is happening with one of the authors of the report, Professor David Taylor Robinson from the University of Liverpool. David, welcome.
Thanks very much. Well, you've said all the key points. It is rather shocking, I think, the findings of this report. Yeah, I'm a public health professor. I work at the University of Liverpool, and I'm a consultant in public health at Alder Hey Children's Hospital, and we see firsthand the impact of social problems and social adversity affecting children, affecting all sorts of aspects of children's health. And we see the impact of children entering the care system and the challenges, the real challenges for services locally, health, social care, education and criminal justice in looking after those kids. So I think the report is a really important one, and I don't know if you've come across the Child of the North report. Have you seen our Child of the North report?
Yes, that was out a little while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it's a couple of years ago now, but the Child of the North report looked at all sorts of aspects of children's health and considered inequalities, and the entry point was post-COVID recovery and the North-South divide, and it was put together by hospitals across the north and by the NA, the eight big northern research intensive universities. And I led the report from Liverpool with Kate Pickett from the University of York. And then that led to an all-party parliamentary group on children's health, which has been running since last year. And we've picked up on kind of critical issues raised in the original report. So we've done a report on child poverty and the cost of living crisis. There was a report on educational inequalities affecting kids. But the MPs, the cross-party group of MPs, were keen to pick up on the chapter on looked after children, which I did think was one of the most striking, really, because as you say, a lot of people don't. I knew about these differences, and this data is, you know, publicly available for anybody to look at, and it's a big issue for lots of local authorities. But people, I don't think it gets the coverage that it should get compared to issues like mental health or obesity or some of these health issues that we focus on. And I think that's an issue where we're not giving due attention to some of the most marginalised kids in society.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I alluded to this earlier, but if you look at the rates of looked after children in areas like Blackpool, or I think Hartlepool has a very high rate as well, and you compare it to places like Hertfordshire in the southeast of England, there's a huge disparity there. And I mean, what is the knock-on impact for the children themselves? I mean, obviously you work, you know, on the front line in this respect, and the local areas where these disparities are to be seen.
Yeah, well, there's a wealth of evidence, and a lot of my research is on the impact of childhood adversities, you know, bad things that happen to you early in childhood. And there are lots of longitudinal studies where whole populations have been followed up, where we can look at the effect of childhood adversity on risk of death in adulthood, on the risk of developing mental health problems. Have you still got me? My camera keeps doing something funny. Sorry about
that. No, I can see you. No, yeah. I can see you. Absolutely fine.
On, you know, involvement in the criminal justice system, etc. And it's, you know, things like that. It's that type of social adversity that essentially leads to children entering care. And obviously care is supposed to be protective subsequently. And it's quite difficult epidemiologically disentangling, you know, the harmful effects of the things that cause children to enter care and the experience of care itself. But we do know that children who go in and young people who enter care compared to the general population have much worse health outcomes across all domains. And actually, in some of the latest data shows that for more recent cohorts, those effects are getting bigger. So we cover a lot of that evidence in the report. I guess, I mean, I don't know if people know, but on average, the number of kids in the care system in England, for example, which was the focus of the report, has increased year on year for over the last 15 to 20 years. So there are over 83,000 children in the care system in England. That's a record high. So this is a problem everywhere. So it's a problem for the whole of the country. But, you know, what you see from the data is that it's particularly driven by high numbers of children in the system and high rates of care entry in areas in the north. And yeah, you know, Blackpool hit the headlines yesterday. I mean, it's one in 65 kids in Liverpool here where I work. In Hartlepool it was something similar. And you know, there is a very, very pronounced north-south divide. So if you look at number of children per thousand, it's about 6 per thousand in care in the south, compared to it's getting near to 1 in 100 kids in the whole of the north of England who are in the care system. It's 9.3 per 10,000.
That's so astonishingly that to me is a shocking statistic. 1 in 100 children in the care system. It's extraordinary, really.
Yeah, and there are 30 local areas where there are more than 1 in 100 kids in care and in the country, and 20 of those are in the north. And you can look up that data on the Department for Education website, and you can see those rates. So they're all routinely published. But we got into this pre-pandemic. We did some work looking at the trends, and I obviously thought this is because I've done a lot of work on, you know, trends in mental health, obesity, other things that are affecting children at the moment. And the first question was what explains this trend, and what's to, so we did Devara Bennett, who's my colleague who led the report. She did a number of studies for her PhD here in Liverpool, one of which was published in The Lancet, the big medical journal. And she looked at how the extent to which changing rates of child poverty have explained those changing rates of children entering care. And what she shows that is that there's a causal effect of, I won't go into the methods, but using, you know, the statistical approaches, we show clear evidence of a causal effect of poverty on children's care entry. And then we look at some of the economic consequences of that. So we show that rising child poverty between over a 5-year period, I think it was 2000, it was pre-pandemic that we had the data. It was between 2015 and 2020. Rising child poverty over that period caused an extra 10,000 children to be taken into care. And just the short-term costs to local authorities of looking after those kids was 1.9 billion. So, you know, a large sum of money. And to put that into, and that was, it's more of an issue in the north compared to the south, that problem, the problem of, because we have more child poverty in the north. And then, you know, to put that into context, to get rid of the two child limit would cost 1.3 billion. And that would lift about a quarter of a million children out of poverty. So the whole story is one of, you know, failure in prevention at huge cost to individuals and families and at huge cost to local economies. Yeah, and the headline figure that you said earlier of, you know, if you look at the lifetime costs of being taken into care, Josh McAllister's care review provides some of the evidence for the long-term economic impacts of care entry. So using that data and the data from our studies, we estimated 25 billion over a five-year period could have been saved by agencies in the north if we had the same care rates that you have in the south. So, you know, astronomical sums of money. I think if that, you know, this is a common story across all of our reports. We're investing money in failure. You know, we're continually investing in crisis, in health and in social care. And what we need to do is reprofile some of that into prevention and into reducing the root causes of some of the problems. And child poverty is one of the, you know, one of the things that's holding back the country, and particularly the north of England, and particularly areas like Liverpool where I work.
Yeah. Because I imagine there will be some people who read this report and say this is really shocking stuff, but that in order to tackle these deep-seated problems, in order to tackle the inequalities in terms of poverty and life opportunities that are causing this, is going to cost a lot of money at a time when the country doesn't have a lot of money. And I'm guessing your answer to that, as you just alluded to, is that it's about spending money on different things to what we're currently spending on. It's about spending that, putting that resource into prevention rather than tackling the symptoms once they arise.
Yeah, it may sound trite, but prevention is better than cure. And you know, the sixth richest country, but we're 27th for children's health. You know, you can't run a country or have a productive economy or do any of these things if lots of the young people in the country are written off because of poor health and social adversity early in life. You know, and we need forward thinking policies that invest a little bit. And prevention is cheap. A lot of this stuff is cheap. And we show in this report that it's completely false economy to allow children to enter the care system, because it's, you know, it's one of the reasons why local authorities are going bust at the moment, because of all the spend on, you know, the acute spend on looking after children in the care system. I think there are a number of other arguments. I think the, you know, the argument about reprofiling the spend, you know, if you believe that there's no money there, you can certainly reprofile some of that spend so that we prevent some of these consequences. And again, the economic arguments are very strong. Heckman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, showed that you know, you get a tenfold return on investment for some of these early year prevention interventions. So investing early to prevent these health and social care problems is undoubtedly the way to go. But we seem to be locked in a system that can't move some of that money around. So I think that is that, you know, some of this is about local government finance and where, who has to put in the investment and where the return on investment falls across the whole system. So there are things that need sorting out there. But we did, you know, how much did the test and trace system cost in the pandemic that didn't really work? That was
many billions,
39 billion or something. So, you know, for certain things, we can get a lot of money overnight and give it to, you know, private companies to set up systems that don't do their job, but we seem not to be able to make the argument to invest in you know, the future of the country, children and young people. So I think there are really powerful arguments that it's, you know, morally the right thing to do to address some of these stark problems, but it's also economically clearly the right thing to do.
Yeah. Is part of the answer helping parents perhaps or families when they're struggling? I think in a discussion this week that on GB News or something similar, Nigel Farage suggested that parents have a lot of responsibility for this happening. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with that as the main focus, but presumably part of the answer is helping parents and families so that their children can stay with them or be more likely to, and don't have to go into the care system.
Yeah, obviously you need to address the root causes. Poverty causes poverty causes family mental health problems, family breakdown, causes children to be more at risk of violence, to be neglected. So you can tackle the upstream causes. And then you need to provide, if we are going to run a country where a third of the kids are in poverty, you need to do a good job investing in early prevention services that can help mitigate some of those impacts. But again, in the report, we show that things like Sure Start, which are magical, it turns out to be a magical intervention in terms of its impacts on all sorts of health outcomes. But we showed that the cuts, the other main story in the report is that the cuts to local government spending on children, so prevention spend, the type of services that you're talking about, they've been cut at the same time as rising child poverty. And one of Devara's other papers shows a causal effect of cuts to those prevention services that led particularly teenagers, particularly services, youth, services that support young adolescents, they've been cut back dramatically. And that has also led to a greater risk of children entering care. And again, we do the economics of it, and the money that was saved through the cuts is outweighed by the expense of looking after those children once they're taken into local authority care. So you need both. You need tiered services that prevent. You need universal services that can pick up families that are struggling. You need more specialist services that can help, families that are teetering on the edge. But the trouble is we've seen rising child poverty and cuts to all of those services at the same time. And that is a big part of the explanation for why we're seeing the problems that we're seeing at the moment.
So I think there'll be a lot of northern political leaders listening to that and nodding their heads. David Taylor Robinson from the University of Liverpool, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McCoughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. See you next week.